Your Honor, I have, because it involves some relatively sharp switch from a policy in terms of physical three of the policy provisions up. I've got handouts for the court of the court.
If you'll give them to the bailiff, he'll distribute them. Thank you.
And Your Honor, if I do not, I just put them up here since I tripod is going to be difficult.
That's fine. Wherever
you can move.
We'll tell you if we have trouble seeing them. You may want to put them, you know, kind of behind you instead of blocking the view.
I'll probably just hold them up here.
Okay, that's fine.
I'll do the same thing. So let's do that one. Okay. The court, may it please the court. Again, my name is Russ Waters, and I'm here with my partner Mike Ward. The single issue and question presented by this appeal concerns the architecture and structure of an insurance policy. What is the proper role of a declarations page and its relationship to the body of the policy and the actual provisions of the insurance contract that exist between the carrier and the insured? I'd like to take a minute to summarize for the court the importance of this court's decision in this case and in the case that follows my argument in the Shelter case. This case, with all due respect to the court, the appellate courts and trial courts, and in fact the one area I do agree with plaintiff's brief on, or respondent's brief on, is that there is a state of confusion within the trial bar and the lower courts with regard to what a declarations page means, despite the fact that this court in Floyd versus Tunnel just recently spent a lot of time discussing a declarations page vis-a-vis the provisions of the policy. With the deck page versus, well, in the bar is called the deck page versus policy provision discussions as it relates specifically to UIM coverage as to gap coverage versus excess coverage. And I point out to the court that those are two very distinct types of insurance coverages. And why the ramifications go beyond UIM, as it's been discussed in UIM in Manor, Jones, and Ritchie, is because anecdotally I will tell the court that this has now been extended to stacking cases, in other words, in liability policies, all policies. There have been now trial courts and positions taken that because there's no notation on the deck sheet that even though the language in the policy regarding anti-stacking is clear and unambiguous, that it makes the policy as a whole ambiguous. It's gone to MedPay coverages, same item in MedPay coverages, where if you don't have some type of anti-stacking language on the deck sheet, even though it's clear and unambiguous in the policy provisions, it makes the policy as a whole ambiguous. It's gone so far as to, even in a first-party context, where we have a case where a replacement cost policy on a building, which had a total amount of policy limits of $100,000 and replacement cost value, is because there wasn't something on the deck sheet indicating that ACV is what is paid until you replace, that makes the policy as a whole ambiguous. So that's why this court in the decision
and the cases have been clear that you don't just look at the deck sheet. They haven't said it's irrelevant either, though. You look at the whole agreement, which includes the deck sheet, the insuring agreement, the limits of liability, everything.
Is correct. Right? And the problem that we're having, Your Honors, is, and I think there's a misreading of Jones, Ritchie, and Manor, because what's happening is the courts, I have one case on a stacking issue, for instance, where the trial judge indicated that the policy provisions are very clear. There is no stacking. But because there's no notation on a declarations page that says there's no stacking as it relates to these coverages, that makes it ambiguous because on the deck page, there's no indication to the insured that he doesn't stack these various costs.
And I can't address a hypothetical case.
I understand.
But here, opposing counsel argues you don't just have the deck sheet and the limits of liability provision. You have other parts of the policy that refer the insured to the deck sheet and say it sets things out, and that's different than just having two unrelated provisions there. That's what they're saying in combination makes it ambiguous.
Well, in this case, I think if you read the respondent's brief, they almost agree. I can't find anything in the respondent's brief, and I think now is an opportune time to
Think they point to the place in the appendix where you, a quick guide to your policy, the declarations contain your name, policy terms, coverages, limits of liability, and then they point to the insuring agreement, which is one of the things you've highlighted, which says that we, the attached declarations describe the automobiles we insure and the coverages and limits of liability for which you've paid a premium. And they said that creates an ambiguity. I know you have a response to that, but they very clearly argue
they do that. But the problem that the policy, those provisions are not what we have in Jones, which forms the basis of Jones, Ritchie, and Manor. Those provisions, specifically what they failed to point out, and if we look at legal file 145, which is that, I will point to that one specifically, because that's one that Your Honor has pointed out, is what they don't point out is the very same provision. The same provision where it's referred to the declarations page, it also says, which respondent fails to point out, is read your policy carefully. This cover sheet provides only a brief outline of some of the important features of your policy, which is the purpose of a declarations page.
Well, they do argue in this case that all they got by the time it became effective was the declarations page, and that the later the policy itself came later after the insurance was already in effect. So what are you saying they need to read at the time they're signing
up? Your Honor, that is... I will tell the court and represent to the court that that was not a part of the stipulation of fact, and I will represent to the court that that, in fact, is not what occurred. This insured, and if you read our brief and our legal file, this insured was insured by auto owners since 2003. This insured had policies of insurance available to them since 2003. In 2010, if you read the actual, what they actually submit, you will see that there are two submissions in the year of this policy. Those submissions in the legal file specifically show that this was a renewal policy. This is not a new policy. This is a renewal policy.
And so did something say you're bound by our prior policies, or did it say they were sending a new policy that set out the provisions? You're not saying there weren't new terms in the policy, or if there were, they wouldn't be bound by them.
I am not saying that, no, but there were no new terms. I mean, as you can see in the legal file, this UIM change took place in 2010. It's effective 2010. These insurers had this UIM endorsement and policy since 2010. What's referred to in the legal file is simply, it's a bill we get in the mail. In other words, this policy was expiring.
Is there something in what they were sent with the declarations page and so forth that says all the terms are the same as in your prior policy, refer to it?
It says, yeah, I mean, if you read the entire, that's what it explains to the policyholder. It says, read your policy.
No, which policy, though, are they talking about?
Well, when you get a renewal policy in, normally speaking in the industry, you don't get a whole new policy, and you only get what might be a change in the policy for that year. In some, maybe some send out a new policy every year, but on a renewal policy, you have...
Mr. Ward has something.
I'm sorry, thank you. What comes out, automobile policy description of changes effective 10/31/2013. Okay. So what it says is, if there aren't any changes, your policy you had before is in effect. That's your policy. And what's interesting about this declaration, or this letter or notice that goes out, it also says, if you don't have it, you can check your website, plug in your policy number, and you can read your policy on the website, in case some of us throw our policy away. But the idea that they didn't have this UIM coverage policy is a bit disingenuous, because we know they did. And as part of the stipulation of fact, this was never raised before the trial court. They had this policy, and I don't think they'll dispute that.
And in addition, when you're referring to the notice that went out to them that referenced the declaration, the deck page, it even gave them the policy, told them to go to the website, gave the policy number, and gave them their personal ID code, so they had everything on that sheet telling them exactly how to get to the policy.
Exactly. This idea that they use the word bait and switch, and this is not a bait and switch operation. This is a major insurance carrier that's simply renewing its policy year after year after year with the same insured. And I will represent to the court, in our... This particular provisions that were written on this UIM for gap coverage, and this is what this is, it's a gap coverage UIM endorsement, was written in 2010 in response to Ritchie and Jones. Because as I understand it, and Ritchie and Judge Smith, you're more of an expert on these decisions than I am, but in Ritchie and Jones, this court indicated that the reason that there was a problem was not necessarily the deck sheet, but there was conflicting provisions in the policy. where the policy provision said, we will pay up to the limits of your policy under UIM that's contained on your deck sheet. And they mentioned that in several occasions. And then later in the policy, they tried to take that away and say, well, no, we're not really going to do that. We're going to take a set off to the limits of that policy based upon what the tortfeasor's carrier might be. And this court held in Ritchie and in Jones, you can't do that.
Is there anything, and one of the cases, I forget which now, gave an example of things you could do to appropriately limit your liability, but I'm unclear from the briefs here. Opposing counsel says it would be simple to change the deck page to clarify this and make it clearer that what's set out there is not the actual limit that will apply in any case. And you say it's more complicated, but I mean, is there any explanation why it doesn't just say as limited in section blank infra or something like that?
You could change your policy. You could change your deck sheet. But the deck sheet, again, under tunnel, is just a brief, informative description. If we start, and this is why this case is so very important, Your Honors, is because if this court would hold that you need to change your deck sheet, which the court has never done up till today, that you need to change the deck sheet to be more specific and refer to this particular gap coverage, where does that stop? Because as they say, when E.F. Hutton speaks, everybody listens. So
I think their point is by simply setting it out in the deck page without any explanation, you create the impression that's the coverage because that's what it says. And some of our cases have said you can't look at the deck sheet alone, but the question is, reading it as a whole and given all the cross-references and so forth, is it confusing?
The very nature of GAP, I didn't mean to cut you off, Your Honor.
No, that's right.
The very nature of GAP coverage is that you have to have a limit in your declaration sheet because that's from where you start the reduction depending upon whatever you're using as a reduction in that GAP coverage. In Floyd Tunnel, this court just recently said at the outset, the policy's declarations pages do not grant any coverage. The declarations state the policy's essential terms in an abbreviated form, and when the policy is read as a whole, it is clear the reader must look elsewhere to determine the scope of coverage. The declarations are only introductory in nature and subject to refinement of the policy. And I represent to this court that throughout the policy, we continually tell the insured, read your policy for the actual coverages. It's set up. Every time they say, look at the declarations page, if you'll note in the legal file, there's also a line right after that, read your policy for your coverages. Again, if the court would require, for instance, gap coverage to be noted on this policy, on the deck sheet, then does it stop there, or then do we have to list anti-stacking language? Then do we have to start listing, am I out of time?
We are out of time.
Then we're going to have to start listing exclusions. And if you say, then if they start listing things, then the things you don't list, they're going to say, well, you must have waived that because you didn't list it on the deck sheet. It will defeat the purpose of a deck sheet, Your Honor.
We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Before you get started, I just have a curiosity. Have there ever been any studies or any data as to the percentage of policyholders who actually read their policies?
Your Honor, I would say I'm aware of no study on that using Mr. Waters' anecdotal evidence. I will tell you it's not just the average insured. When I give discussions on insurance across the state, I often have lawyers come up and ask me, well, how can that be? If it says this, why am I not actually getting that?
But they
don't read that.
The law requires a person who is a party to a contract to be bound by the language in the contract. And so they have an obligation to read that contract and know what it says. And I ask that question because I think that's kind of the defense. Well, we shouldn't be obligated to read the contract, or that's the maybe not the defense, the proposition. They should be bound by what's in their summary, because I assume credit card agreements Maybe my husband reads them, but I certainly don't. And so if we rule in your favor, don't we have to overturn that precedent and say, you know what, it's okay not to read your policies, and the person you have a contract with has to describe it just so you kind of get the gist of it?
I do not believe so, and we specifically attempted to tailor our argument to that point, Your Honor. When the cases that were cited in the appellant's brief talking about the duty to read your policy, those have to do with reformation of the contract or simply taking that provision out because it wasn't sufficiently clear to the insurer. This is a different argument. This is in the history of the course of what occurred here. It was ambiguous. Did you give the insured the implication? And what they agree is, if the policy indicated to an average insured that they would pay $250,000, they owe the disputed $50,000 of coverage.
But that impression has to come from reading the entire contract and reading the paragraph that says, under no, you know, we are not obligated to pay you the full amount.
And, Your Honor, that goes back to part of the argument. There's two parts here in the briefing. And, unfortunately, I do disagree with Mr. Waters in regard to what the record actually shows. And I would ask the court to go back and actually look at the record citations that are in owner's brief that are cited in their reply brief. The reason I say that is because the first time the argument was made that this was a renewal or the Craigs ever saw this policy before what was a uncontested fact at trial, that they received the policy on November 6th, a week after it went into effect,
but they,
was
they
their reply brief.
Prior to it going into effect, they received the notice that you're relying on that makes the reference, it enclosed your policy declarations. And that notice has a statement that says, here's your policy is online, here's the policy number, here's your ID code, and says, please review your policy carefully. It doesn't say review the declarations carefully.
Yes, Your Honor, and there is, I guess it goes back to whose burden is it to make it clear? If it was the burden of my client, the insured who's purchasing the insurance, to make it clear, then that might be the case. However,
to make what clear? That you have
to make the terms?
Okay.
I'm sorry,
right.
I didn't mean to speak.
Yeah. So the point is there an ambiguity? If there isn't any, everybody agrees the policy terms apply, right? So your suggestion is that because it didn't all come together, that also makes it an ambiguity.
That's one element.
And it seems like to me Judge Breckenridge is saying, well, it all came together if they read the notice.
Actually, Your Honor, there's no case that has ever put an affirmative duty on an insured to be computer literate, to have a computer, to go to the website, to enroll. One of the things the notice says is you have to enroll and put that information in there, and then review it when the insured chooses to send you solely the declarations page, which reinforces the $250,000 number. And so, yes, I would argue that is part of the process of buying the insurance policy. Owners could have chosen to send the entire policy. Mm-hmm. And the argument
could they decide to provide a policy with no declarations page at all?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Could they decide to just provide a policy with no declarations page?
I've never seen that.
That might be what occurs.
In this circumstance, one thing we know, and that's why when I heard the parade of horribles Mr. Waters went through, I'm here not to talk about any of those. I'm here specifically for the limited purpose of UIM coverage and the facts in this case. And UIM coverage is different. The Floyd Tunnel case had to do with whether or not additional policies had to be. There was never any indication in the Floyd Tunnel case that the underlying coverage of the primary policy wouldn't pay. Here, by nature, and this court has found in all three of the decisions, Jones, Ritchie, and Manor, the UIM is a slightly different animal because you will always have some amount of coverage that is coming off of what is on there. If that's not made clear to the average insured, they have no way to know that.
I want to clarify something. I didn't understand you to be arguing that that one provision read alone, the limitation of liability, was unclear, or that you can not read your policy and then say it's unclear, but that you can't deny coverage in one place and grant it in another, and that you can't say, well, you should have known we meant this later one, that the insured, their specific cases say you cannot have inconsistent provisions in the policy and then say the insured should have known which one governed. If you grant coverage or appear to in one and deny it in another, that's an ambiguity, and we always resolve that against the insurer that wrote the policy. So here, what would you guide us to as to what you think is inconsistent, says there is coverage? Here, we all know what says there's not coverage in the limit of liability. Opposing counsel says there's not really another thing that appears to grant coverage to create an ambiguity, but you say there is.
I would say is you have to look at the formation of the contract from the beginning. And when you go back and look, the record evidence before the trial court was the only thing the Craigs initially received, they began purchasing this policy of insurance, this specific policy, in September of 2013 to go into effect in October. They chose that they wanted $250,000 of UIM coverage. Auto owners then send them a declarations page showing $250,000 of UIM coverage and ask them to review that and confirm that it accurately sets out the coverage as they want. The average insured, when they see I'm getting $250,000 of UIM coverage and there's nothing else provided with it, would understand that to mean they're getting $250,000.
But don't you have to look at the purpose of what the deck page is? And according to Floyd Chano, the policy's declarations page do not grant any coverage. The declarations state the policy's essential terms in an abbreviated form, and when the policy is read as a whole, it is clear that a reader must look elsewhere to determine the scope of the coverage.
And that's difficult to do when the insurance company makes the choice. They're the master of their policy. They're the master of how they send this out. They chose not to include the policy. A lot of insurance companies sell actual $250,000 worth of coverage, and there's no issue of offset. Owners chooses to attempt to take an offset, and they choose not to provide that information to the insured in the initial purchase process. Then, when you get, and again, if you'll look, the one thing I do want to mention before my time is up is the record evidence that was before the trial court never mentions the word renewal. The pages that were cited do not mention the word renewal. That is nowhere in any of those documents. The identification of the change has to do with what's called the paid in full discount, because my client paid in full the full amount rather than be billed monthly, and so their premium went down $2 and I believe 83 cents between what they were originally quoted in September. They then paid the full policy and they were told you saved $2.83. That is the change that is noted as to the premium. The word renewal is not in there anywhere. There's no record evidence of that. And if you go through the arguments below, that issue was raised, and I can provide the court the
citation. Going back to Judge Stiss' question, she asked you specifically what printed language causes the ambiguity. I believe your response was simply the deck sheet. Is there other language in the policy that you think contributes to cause an ambiguity, or is it simply the deck sheet does not mention the setup?
It is the deck sheet. It's also their term of their use of the word limits. One of their arguments is that if we had promised to pay, you know, a maximum amount, we would be liable for that. We didn't actually do that. Actually, they chose to use the word limits. They also chose not to define limits. Limits legally under the case authority means the maximum amount we will pay. Further, as for an average insured, when you go and you look at what does the word limits means, it means a maximum amount of something, the maximum amount of coverage. And so they've used the word limits. They chose to use the word limits, and they chose to put that the limits of this policy were $250,000. Therefore, they're indicating and making a, as they call it, a promise that at some point under some circumstances, they will pay $250,000. However, they also concede under no possible circumstances will that actually ever occur. And so the initial process, you keep referring the insured to the declarations page as where their coverage is. When you actually get the policy, a week after you paid for it, around October 12th, you get the policy about a month later when it's already been in effect for a week, and you actually get the policy. When you get the policy, then it refers you not once but twice in the policy to go to the declarations page to find out the, quote, limits or limits of liability.
And so that's what you're saying is ambiguous. It doesn't refer you just to the limits of liability section, but to the deck page.
Yes.
And that is what creates the ambiguity as to what the coverage is.
And so what I would call the cover your assets portion of the provisions that Mr. Waters cited several times as to read the policy, that's just what makes it ambiguous. You're referring them over here to look how much coverage do you have. If you're damaged sufficiently, how much will you be paid? And it's an undisputed stipulated fact that my client was more than sufficiently damaged to call for the full policy coverage they purchased and paid for, absent this offset.
To be clear, are the two places that it refers in the policy to the deck page for coverage?
The first page is on the quick index guide, Your Honor. Which is cited in our brief, and it says that the limits of liability.
That's this page. That's.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. He's got it highlighted. It's obviously not highlighted in the policy, but the quick index page, and it has the language above is what's highlighted. But when you go below. What's not highlighted, and I'm sorry, I have to take my glasses off. I've got to the point where I can't read. It says a quick guide to your policy. The declarations contain, it says your name, policy terms, your automobile, coverages, limits of liability. And so limits of liability has both a technical term under the law, meaning how much you will pay at some point under some condition, and then it also means to the average person, a limit means how much is the maximum somebody's on the hook for. Here, under their argument, that's contradictory, and that is what is ambiguous or gives coverage in one portion and takes it away. The other is in the limits of liability provision, which is one of the other, and it says, the attached declarations, again referring you back to the declarations, which is what they've reinforced primarily throughout the entire purchase process, describe the automobiles we insure and the coverages and limits of liability for which you have paid a premium. And that, again, reinforces what the Craigs were told. They were told they were purchasing $250,000 of coverage, and here's how much the premium for that coverage was. They paid that premium. So multiple places, they are referred to, this is the most we will pay. Owners now says, under no circumstances will we ever actually pay that. And that is the ambiguity that this court has found in other circumstances.
But they actually have that in under limit of liability. They expressly say, under no circumstances do we have a duty to pay you or any person entitled to underinsured motors coverage under this policy the entire limits of liability.
Which is inconsistent with their promise that at some point we will pay you $250,000, because that is by definition what limits of liability mean.
Well, they expressly say, you said they don't define limits of liability, but doesn't that provision I just read say what limits of liability means in this policy?
I don't believe so, and the reason is it certainly doesn't say we will never pay you. It says, it basically leaves it ambiguous as to whether under certain circumstances, they may not pay you, but it still leaves open the possibility that they may pay you the full amount. I believe my time is up unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
May it please the court.
So why not just write the policy for $1 billion and say, under no circumstances will we ever pay you that amount?
Well, if you have gap coverage, that might be inappropriate. It might be appropriate to do so. I mean, but you have to then charge a heck of a premium for $1 million in coverage.
Well, why if we're never going to give it?
No, it's gap coverage.
The question is, can you mislead someone in the declarations page by making up a number you're not going to do? Here you're saying you couldn't just put anything that was misleading in the declarations page and say it doesn't matter what we say there. I assume. Are you saying you could?
No.
So what they're saying is it's misleading.
It's not misleading, Your Honors, and I will tell you why. If you look at your case of Jones and Ritchie and Manor, all three of those cases had an explicit promise to pay the limits.
Right.
Very explicit. There, somehow, respondent wants to infer there's a promise. There is no promise in our policy. In fact, in every area of the policy, we tell them, read the policy. And where the UIM gap coverage is described, it is very clear and very specific as to what we may or may not pay or what we have a duty to pay. Any person that reads that understands that $250,000, that limit may never be paid to you based upon
it will never. His point is it's misleading because it will never. Not
it will never.
And that ties into Jones and Ritchie and the other cases, which said you can't say you're going to pay something you know by definition you never will because it's underinsured, not uninsured. So the first part is always paid by somebody
Judge,
else.
Your Honor, but I understand, but under no circumstances, then we get into whether this is ambiguous or not. And that really hasn't been argued in their brief. They did not make that argument.
Mm-hmm.
They made the simple argument that because we refer to the declarations page in the body of the petition and there's no body of the policy and there's no notation on the deck sheet, that taken as a whole is ambiguous. They have never utilized the argument that limits of liability in their brief anyway that I recall. Did they make that, and I can see why, because this is fairly clear. And I think in the three cases we're talking about, the court hinged on the fact that there was an actual promise to pay up to the limits throughout the policy. There are no such promises in this policy. And the very nature, to get to Judge Drapier's argument, the very nature of gap coverage. In other words, if the court was as a matter of public policy, you can't write gap coverage, which is a cheaper premium than excess coverage, then you don't write it. But the very nature of gap coverage, you have to start with a limit from which you deduct what is defined as the gap. It's in automobile insurance. It's throughout. And in the court
it doesn't say gap coverage anyplace, does it? But we're to understand that from the definition of limits.
That's the definition. In insurance industry, I think we can both agree. There's excess coverage and there's gap coverage. Gap coverage is one where you take a deduction from the limit, and it's to make up the gap.
And my question, I understand what it is, but my question is, does the insured understand when they're getting the policy what the difference is and which one they're getting?
Well, I mean, if they read the policy provision, if you read the limit of liability B1 and 2, it's defined. It's defined as clearly as can be. It says we will take a deduction from the amount of the tortfeasor's policy as to the limits as defined. I mean, if you read this entire thing in its entirety, he's concentrating on just this where it says it warns the insurer we're not going to pay this. But then read B1 and 2, and it tells the insurer exactly what we are going to pay and how the gap coverage works. And again, there's no arguments that B1 and 2 are ambiguous. In fact, it's clear. Their whole argument reflects back to the deck sheet. And should there be notations on the deck sheet? And our position, Your Honors, is no, there shouldn't be. Because once you go down that path, he says there's no other coverages. There's drop-down coverage. There's permissive use coverage. There's deductions taken in MedPay. You don't put notations on every one of those policy provisions. You have to read the policy.
Your time is up.
Okay.
Thank you for a well-argued case and for your good arguments in your briefs.